Creasy is the PVA Professor of Spinal Cord Injury at Stanford University and Chief of Spinal Cord Injury Service here at the VA. And his research interest includes the restoration of function for spinal cord injury, which is pretty obvious, and using information technology and biotechnology. And we'll also be meeting up with Mark Samuels, who's an occupational therapist and certified driving rehabilitation specialist here at the VA. He treats individuals with a wide range of diagnoses, including traumatic brain injuries, spinal cord injuries, amputations, dementia, strokes, post-traumatic stress disorders, orthopedic injuries, and so on and so on. Mark maintains professional certifications in the physical agent modalities and is a workplace dispute resolution mediator, and he's a certified driving specialist, and he's affiliated with the AOTA and which is the American Occupational Therapy Association. So, without further ado, I'd like to thank Dr. Creasy for hosting us today, and let's see what he has to say.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much, and thank you for making the trip out here. I've known David since I used to visit him when he worked here in the 80s. And I used to visit him because they were doing such cool stuff here with assistive technology. So whenever I came over from Britain, and you can tell I come from Britain, I would try and make a beeline over to the West Coast and then down to Palo Alto and down to the VA to see what they were doing in the Rehabilitation Research and Development Center, which is the next building over from here. And that's a VA research center which has focused for a long time on rehabilitation engineering and assistive technology. And they had a lot of very bright graduate students and faculty from Stanford inventing all sorts of interesting things, especially for sporting equipment, exercise equipment, skiing, bicycling, as well as using robots, and exploring all sorts of technology that you could use for disability. Because the whole thing about disability is you need more tools. We all use tools, but the more disabled you are, the more tools you need. And this particular building and this particular VA specializes in rehabilitation of people who've had major disabilities like injury to the brain or the spinal cord. We also have a blind or low vision rehabilitation unit here, an amputee rehabilitation as well. And of course, this is very relevant to Iraq and Afghanistan, where people are having multiple injuries, sometimes called polytrauma, and typically war results in those kind of multiple injuries. In fact, the head injury is said to be the signature injury of Iraq because people are getting blown up by IEDs, and the more the armored vehicles are armored, the bigger the IEDs become. So it used to be that the explosive devices would destroy the vehicle. As they've made the vehicles heavier and more armored now, the explosive devices are bigger, and they just throw the vehicle up in 30 or 40 feet in the air. It comes down on its roof. And if you're inside, you get rattled around as if you're in a tin can. So you may hit your head on the inside. You may break your neck, damage your spine. And the important things about that, of course, are that your head, your skull, is a very useful bony cavity to protect your brain. And your spine is a pretty strong bony cavity to protect your spinal cord. Because that's really our communication network in the body, our brain, and our for all the conscious and unconscious control of what we do. And then the spinal cord is really like the main cable from your brain to your body, protected in a lot of its traffic, and then it fans out from the spinal cord in branches out to all your muscles and the rest of the body, where it sends messages to allow you to move and takes back in all the sensory information to know what you're, so that you know what you're feeling. Sometimes, of course, a lot of what happens is we're not even conscious of. We call that those automatic functions, the autonomic nervous system, which control our heart rate and our blood pressure and our breathing and our temperature and how our bowel works and to some extent how our bladder works. And a lot of those things we're not even conscious of, but they're also under control of the brain. And so if you damage the main cable to the computer, or if you damage the computer up here, then it's a fairly devastating injury. Any comparable things, I suppose, in the rest of the world is strokes, when you have a blood clot or a bleed in the brain or the spinal cord. So those are these devastating kind of injuries that can range all the way from a mild brain injury, where it's just a concussion like you might suffer in football, all the way up to having been in a coma for a while or being in a coma for the rest of your life. But in between that, there's a lot of severe physical and mental and social consequences, because very often the brain injury, quite apart from any physical things it does, it may make you very irritable, very impatient, very poor at communicating, which puts a lot of stress on your family. The spinal injuries, it's really, as I say, like cutting the cable, so cutting off the control of movement and muscles, cutting off the feeling that comes up. And so the obvious consequences are paralysis. And people always think of that as, of course, not being able to walk. And that's why so many of you, I'm afraid, don't have chairs, because most people here have their own chair with wheels on. And so we don't have any chairs because people bring their own. And people always think of paralysis as not being able to walk, and the symbol of the wheelchair is universal. But not being able to feel is just as important, partly for things like sitting as you're sitting. If you sit as you do, and if I talk for long enough, you'd start to fidget, you'd get uncomfortable, you'd feel a little sore because you'd be cutting off the circulation to the skin that you're sitting on. So you'd get up, you'd move around, you'd change or shift your weight to allow the blood back in. But a person who can't feel that, or who can feel but can't move, ends up cutting off the blood supply to their skin, and therefore the skin and the muscles below it die, and you end up with a great patch of dead meat, which dies and then eventually rots and becomes a big ulcer, and has to be cut out and have dressings or surgery to fix it. So the lack of feeling has a lot of consequences, and the lack of the automatic functions, like controlling your bladder, means if you can't empty your bladder properly, the bladder gets infected, you get stones and other complications like that. On the other hand, it may mean that you empty it when you don't want to, and you leak, you're wet, you have embarrassing accidents when urine or a stool comes out when you don't want it to. So those are things that we don't have an international symbol for that. It would probably be a puddle or a little trail. And so people don't talk about that so much. And they don't talk about the sexual consequences of whether you can still have sexual activity or have a child. Fact is, most people with a broken back can have sexual activity and can have children. But in the old days, it was thought that you were impotent and as well as incontinent and infertile. And this was the public perception. So a lot of what we do in rehab is just re-educating people to know what's possible. And that includes all the physical things, the muscular stuff, the restoring physical function, and this technology comes into that. Restoring sensory function, we are not very far along with that. There's a lot of sensors being developed in the electronic industry, but they haven't really found their way very much into use in medicine yet, although we're talking about ways we could use them, both applying them to people and to the equipment that they use, and documenting people's activity and their exercise, and people like Jeff are doing research on exercise and fitness and wellness. And the fact that if you're sitting in a wheelchair, you get even less exercise than the rest of us. So you're even more prone to obesity, diabetes, heart disease, high blood pressure, and all those other things. Quite apart from all the physical things, of course, there's a lot of social and emotional consequences of disability and paralysis, and we'll talk a bit about that. financial consequences, mobility, housing, and all those things. So speaking of mobility, and since some of you have had to sit on the floor here, let's go and start by seeing some of the mobility options. I imagine most of you got here by driving or sharing a ride. Cyclists, walking, bus, a few. So one of the issues is if you're paralyzed, either in your legs, which we known as paraplegia, or in your arms and legs, tetraplegia or quadriplegia, how do you drive? Can you drive? Are you safe to drive? Would other people want to be on the road at the same time as you? And so how do people get back into just getting around, as you did? So let's go down and see a little driving lab that we have to how we assess whether people are safe to drive and how we teach them to drive with or without assistive technology. We may have to do this in a couple of shifts to see the driving simulator laboratory. So if need be, we can rotate and take turns. Probably may get half or a third of us in. Hi, we've got a large crowd. I'm just thinking whether we need two or three shifts here. Two at least. We think we'll get half in? So this is Mark Samuels, who you heard about from David Jaffe. And he'll show you the kind of things that are done here. And then I'll stay with the second half, and then we'll rotate.
All right, come on in. Okay. If anyone's ever seen it before, scoot to the back. Yeah. You come on out. I'm going to move this chair out of the way. Huh?
Come on.
All the space takers.
Well, they said the short. So by default, we're short.
It's all things are relative.
Yeah, you can get. There you go.
Come on, Scott. Get on our laps.
Here, let's get this out of the way.
Oh. Okay.
Actually, if you speak that way, let me get this chair out of here. I'll make more room.
All right.
No, I don't need to sit for a 10-minute talk. Okay, you go back on in there. All right, everybody. All right, I'll talk while we move. Yep. It helps that they're all on wheels. Okay. All right, my name is Mark Samuels. I'm a certified driving rehab specialist and an occupational therapist. I obviously work here at the DA. I don't want to spend a lot of time going to talk about stuff you don't care about, so I'm not going to tell you about the history of our program. But what's the main topic here seems to be technology as it relates to spinal cord injury. That's what people are interested in, right? Okay. So since you guys are involved in technology, what we're looking at is different levels of injury. Can you return to driving? The answer is generally yes. The question is how much money you got. In the VA, it's not a problem. I also have private clients as well as VA clients separately. In the private sector, for a high-tech van, we always start low-tech. Whenever possible, you want to go low-tech. You don't want to switch the steering column because then you lose the airbag. You don't want to move the passenger seat because then you lose the safety restraints, seat belts. Okay, so you always want to try low-tech. If the person can transfer, have them drive from the vehicle. If they require special adaptive devices to get in and out, do it. As soon as you pull the seat out, you lose the ratio between you and the airbag, you lose the angles, you lose the crash testness of everything. Okay, certain wheelchairs now are crash tested. There are certain restrictions crash tested, but it's all voluntary. There's no federal regulations on that yet. We're working on getting that to be a standard, but as of this point, it is not. So we start low tech. With my people, if you've had a spinal cord injury, maybe numbness, tingling, you know, it could be something really minor. We can move the gas pedal to one side. I'll start with just some basic images here. To be able to control the steering wheel, there's what we call primary controls, secondary controls. Primary, steering, gas, brake, done. Okay? If you can do those, the rest I can windshield wipers, wind air conditioning, turn signals, horn. Yeah, they're important, but if you can't do steering, gas, brake, then we've got a problem. Okay? So we always start with what we call primary controls. So there are different devices to allow people with different physical abilities to interface with that with the steering column. What I'm showing you, those who are steering quad cuff, things that don't require fingers, things that don't require wrist. We can go all the things that only keep. Let's say you have issues with your feet. We can move the gas pedal from here to there. Just moving it over, starting simple. This is the most. You're thinking the high-tech stuff? Nah, it's this stuff. It's the low-tech stuff where someone else gets into the car to park it, the valet, or you went and you drank too much, said, hey, you know, I'm having my sister drive the car. They pop in. You forgot to pull this thing out. They step where they thought the brake was. That's the gas. Now you're in Santa Cruz. People over. That's what happened in Santa Cruz a while ago. Okay. A little more complex right behind you is a hand control mechanism. Hand control is the gas brake. Go ahead, you can go play with it. That is a push-rock. There's push-rock, push-pull, push-right angle, push-twist. Those are the basic configuration. That is a push-rock. You push for the brake, you rock it down towards your leg, that's the gas. Yeah. Yeah, and you don't have to push that hard. If you're pushing in and rocking, some, like that one, will allow you to do both. You live in San Francisco, you need to be able to brake and gas at the same time. Some places, if you have a push-pull, you can't do that. So you have to know where you're living, what sort of conditions you're going to be involved in. Okay? Oops, should go back. EGB, electronic gas and brake. Push forward for the gas. Pull back for the brake, or vice versa, depending how we set it up. We set up little containers on your gas and brake. This is hydraulic. We can do it hydraulic. We can do electronic. There are lots of ways to interface with that. Okay? Single arm drive. He is doing gas forward, brake back. Actually, he's doing gas back, brake forward. And he turns right by tilting by supination and pronation, turning right and left. All his auxiliary controls, I talked about that. He's doing that with his mouth. He has a stick he puts in his mouth, he pushes a button, it puts the car into drive. Pushes another button, turn signals go on. Wipers go on. All these are here. Okay, you notice we have all this space out. We drop the floor. This year, 2011, we can drop the floor 14 inches. You can be up to 11 inches. Gives you more space to get under there. Reason we drop the floor, you've seen those vans that they transport lots of people with, those raised ceilings. Number one, they leak. Number two, if you're going to drive from one of those things, think about it. You standing in the car to drive. What are you looking at? You're looking at the freaking roof. We've got to drop the floor for your eye vision. You want to be able to see out that window. Okay? So if someone ever tries to sell you a vehicle to drive from and just raise your roof up, not going to help you unless you've got a really tall forehead. Okay? If your eyes are going to be where they are, you need to lower that floor so you can see out that window. That's a steering wheel. Okay? It's a small steering wheel. It's electronically. We've removed the actual steering wheel, which means, yes, they've lost the airbag. I could put that anywhere, right here.
Why do you have to remove the steering wheel? Could you just have it there purely as airbag and cut off the actual...
You can. Sometimes the problem is if you're getting this close, normally we have to really get you in there close. We have to pull out the steering wheel to give you that space. You have to have at least 10 inches between you and the airbag for not to bust your face open. So if we have to get you close, you know, usually it's because you're too far away. We do, as a general rule, we do not remove anything unless it has to be removed. That's the number one rule. So all these things you're seeing, this stuff has been removed. Everything you'll see over here, like hand controls, notice the hand controls, you can still use the brakes. My car, my personal car, has hand controls. I can pop them off. I can still use the gas and brake. My wife drives the car, gas, brake, she's good to go. Okay. The idea is you want to be able to take all that out and resell the car. Or if you have a problem, let's say you're driving along, you go into autonomic dysreflexia, you need to be rushed to the hospital, they scoot you into the other chair, someone else hops in, they can drive it. Okay, we want to make it as interface as friendly as possible. By the way, that's showing you that the airbag's gone. Okay, scooter lifts, we do a lot of this other stuff. Moving your mobility device around. There's two things you have to remember when you're driving from a wheelchair. One is that chair can't go anywhere. Right, you're in a crash, I don't care how well you're strapped in, if your chair goes, you're screwed. So first we lock that chair. This is called an easy lock. There's a Q. It's basically a pin that goes on the bottom of your wheelchair, and it goes right into this little V, clips right in, and you're in. If you're a driver, we also put what's called a stabilizer bar in the front, because you can still get a little rocking and twisting. We do put a stabilizer bar as well, that way you don't twist or rock. Okay, so there are different types of ways to do that. And these are just some examples. This is a seat that will back up, turn up and down. It's a six-way seat. We have seats that will actually come out of the vehicle and meet you. You get into it and it brings you into the car. As I said, you can drive from the seat. If you have to drive from a chair, then we need to do something else. But we will do anything we possibly can to keep you in a manufacturer chair. This is a manufacturer chair, just on a different base. These are these interfaces I talked about. You can also do what's called the digitone. We can put that button anywhere that you have control. I can move my leg out a little bit and hit it. Okay, I'll put it down there. Your leg hits it, it goes beep, 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 beep. You know, first beep is your right turn signal. Second beep is your left turn signal. Next one is your horn. Next one's your windshield wipers. You know what each one means. You hit it, beep, 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 hit it again. That's my right turn signal. You touch it again, it goes off. Okay, it's called the digitone. We also have those that tell you each thing, right wiper, left wiper. People hate those because they get kind of annoyed. But it can be done. Different lifts to get you in and out of the vehicles. Just showing you kind of what we have to do with the cars. And because time is fleeting, I need a volunteer. Oh, come on.
Come on.
Thank you, you. Have, hop in there. Because you all want to see it, you know you do. Okay, you're going to be driving. Put your seatbelt on. And we'll put you in a semi-easy condition. Now, in all fairness, I wouldn't ever put a person in and say, go ahead, drive. I'd walk them through where all the controls are, kind of explain everything. What you're going to do is, just like a regular car, step on the brake, put the car into gear, and drive. This will give you a basic feeling of what goes on. In the simulator, I have three scenarios for evaluation purposes. First one is on hospital grounds. They're going 15 miles an hour, very slow. Gives them a chance to get comfortable with the vehicle, gets them comfortable with the controls, the interface. It talks to you. It tells you what to do. For
speed limit on this road.
About the speed limit, because he just passed the speed limit sign. I want to know that he's visually scanning. Every so often, a red horn will appear on the sides. At that point, he will honk the horn. That means he's scanning. What told it? It's okay. So I would normally increase the complexity of the ride as we go. I'm starting him in a fairly complex environment. I can change the weather conditions. I can change the amount of traffic there. I do have pre-established things. The vehicles on the road will follow rules of the road. If he stops and he doesn't go, the other car will just go. If a collision can be avoided, the computer will avoid the collision. So I'm not setting it up to fail, although on occasion I do have a few vehicles that are going to run a light because I told them to. I do have people who will step out into traffic because I told them to. But generally, I know what's going to happen, so I know what to look for. I don't set him up to set him up so he doesn't know. Any questions so far? I want to make sure I get your questions, because if you have things you're interested in, I want to talk about that in particular.
Does it feel like real learning?
No.
It is different than real.
I think the hardest part is like trying to slow down. Like I don't feel like have a good sense of like gauging
yeah.
when
go,
I'm trying
go
to
go ahead, hit a curve. What will happen is the wheel will kick back. It is an interactive. What we do is we turn the lights out. That way he focuses in here. Underneath it does give him the vibration. If he does hit the curb, the wheel does kick back. If you turn to the right and you let go, like in a regular car, it will automatically return. Over return, just like a regular car.
Continue straight, that's the next stop sign.
It's calibrated as an actual car. So it's... Once again, not real. I don't use this. I normally will put someone in a car. I have a car. I have two minivans that have lowered floors that I can transfer people in. I have a full-size van with a high-tech full system that I would show you but is now in repair. Whenever possible, put them in a real car. This is for either training or evaluation. I have to follow the law. If they don't have a driver's license or a permit, I can't put them in a real car yet. So this is a good intermediate step.
Turn right ahead.
No.
Not private property,
no.
They can't
no.
get a car?
No. I cannot put them in a car and have them drive without a driver's license. Do people do it in parking lots and stuff? Yeah, they do. Can I legally? No. And as a federal employee, that would be bad.
How does somebody go about getting their driver's license from here?
Okay. If you don't, I mean, give me an example. You got blown up your You have a valid license, but it got blown up in Iraq? It happens to me a lot. Okay, in that case, I have them contact the DMV. They fax us a copy, or they fax us a temporary permit while they're making the new license. I just need to have a confirmable official documentation from the proper DMV that they're valid. If you don't have a license, or you it's expired, or you lost it, and you didn't know it expired, I will help you contact the DMV and request a learner's permit to learn with me. Yes, you've never driven before, or you never bothered driving, or whatever, you need a permit, or you have a medical condition where you've had a seizure within the past 6 months, you can't drive, I can get a special permit to allow you to drive with me. Because I'm an occupational therapist, I'm a certified driver, you have there. I have that
turn
out.
Turn right ahead. Mirrors.
Excellent question. Anybody else? Devices, what if? Come on. Yeah.
What does it cost?
Excellent question. Okay, here at the VA, I'll do two things, VA and then the real world. VA, we're blessed. I'm spoiled freaking rotten. Most programs, you can't insure them. My high-tech van is, it's an old van, and the conversion is over $100,000 for that conversion. So for an evaluation here, any veteran can be evaluated for free, will be trained for free. If they have what's called loss of use, because of their injury in service, they lost the ability to drive. They are entitled to At this point, $7,000, about to go up to $33,000. That's a one-time for deposit on a vehicle. And they get all the modifications to get in and out, and all modifications to become an independent driver again for free for two vehicles every 4 years of their entire life.
But what is the actual cost when you're doing it?
Private sector?
I understand the individual doesn't pay, but...
Okay. Well, and that would be more the private sector. An evaluation itself usually costs $300 minimum to $600 to $800 for just the evaluation. It usually takes at least 2 hours. My evaluations take a minimum of 2 hours. 1 hour clinical evaluation, 1 hour in-vehicle or simulator evaluation. A modification to a vehicle can be as simple as the left gas installation of that, and it itself costs about $800 to $1,000. Hand controls, a simple mechanical hand control costs approximately $1,400, so $1,400 for that, which is cheap if you're thinking that I can't work anymore. You know, so it really is it can be daunting, and people don't know that it really can be done on the cheap, cheap being, once again, a relative term.
Yeah, but the numbers you said,
it's like, I'm starting with the low numbers. I'm starting with the low, you know, to get in something simple. If you require a modified vehicle, let's say you have to get into your minivan, you purchase a minivan brand new, and you need to drop the floor. Dropping the floor is a major conversion. You cut the frame. If you cut the frame, that company has to crash test that. Okay. So then you're talking $26,000 to drop the floor on a minivan. And then you put in the ramp. Then you put in the kneeling system. Then you put in the lockdown system. Okay, it can add up pretty darn fast. $100,000 is for a high-tech driving system. That system I just showed you with the one arm, that's the $100,000. It's actually a little more now. But just the system to drive with just one hand, without the vehicle, without the lowered floor, without the restraints, just the control system.
How much does it cost to employ a full-time chauffeur?
A lot less.
Really?
But the reality is, it's an independence thing. You know, what would you think if someone told you you can't drive anymore? Good luck getting home. In our society, it's not just about function. I mean, function is vital, but it leads to independence. There's a lot of, someone else can hop in. Until they show up, I'll just keep for anyone who wants. Yeah.
Driving in a regular...
That's why they can be. If you're able to transfer, I'm going to put you in here. Remember, I always said you want to do the minimum as possible. This is an old Saturn. I mean, if you can transfer into your car, a spinal cord injury doesn't mean that you're in a wheelchair. The people with spinal cord injuries who have numbness in their legs, who walk short distances, or in a wheelchair. I had a guy today in a wheelchair, but he can transfer. So I transferred him into my car. Not my personal car, but the VA car. And I had him drive.
And this is just because they haven't driven since their injury, so they're uncomfortable with...
No, because they're driving in a different way. Very often you have to learn... This one here, I do for safe driving. Someone who's had a head injury. I do head injuries. I do dementia. I do amputations. You know, this is the kind of lowest level complexity. Then it gets up to a higher level. No problem.
Okay, you ready for the next?
Yeah.
Do
you have a question?
No, I was just.
Okay, play away.
Okay, next group. Come on in.
Mark? Yes. Yeah, I'll take a look at it. Thank you.
Sure.
They get bashed around a lot.
I remember putting this stuff on.
Yeah, we've changed it out a few times, though.
Yeah.
There's so much we can do about it.
Well, you replaced the 8-track.
Was there an 8-track?
No, in the console, yeah.
Oh, yes, we did.
The 8-track.
Well, they actually had a tape player in that one. I spent $50,000 to get that, and I'm like, really? Tape deck. I made them come back and put a CD in. Okay. So, do we have everybody in who wants to be in? This is a much smaller group than the other group.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll try to answer questions as much as possible. So I'll start with just kind of an overview. My name is Mark Samuels. I'm a certified driving rehab specialist. I'm also a licensed occupational therapist. I do both. I do have a specialty in driving. I do work for the VA. I also do, on occasion, do private clients, so I can speak to the private sector if you have questions in that area. Here at the VA, we're very blessed. I have two simulators. You're not going to find that in the private sector. I have a sedan with modifications. I have two minivans with drop floors, full conversions, full-size high-tech van, a truck with adaptive vehicle controls as well. So, as a general rule, we always start simple, okay? I know this is specifically about spinal cord injury, but with any diagnosis, I always want to start simple. If I can take your vehicle and do this much to it, I will, okay? If I have to do a whole bunch of stuff, it's going to cost money, it's going to be more complex, more things are going to break, okay? So we're always going to start simple. So when I first see a patient, the first thing I want to do is I need to know they can do what's called the primary controls. Primary controls are steering, gas, brake. That's it. If you can do those three, the rest I can handle. Okay? But if you can't do steering, gas, brake, we need to find a way for you to interface with those. So those are the primary controls. So on steering, if you can steer with your steering column, fabulous. I don't need to modify it. I can shrink it. I can reduce the effort. I can relocate it. I don't want to do that because then we lose the advantage of your airbag. I want to have you drive from the seat. I don't want to take that out. I take away the seat. We then lose the ratio between you and your airbag. The setup of the crash-tested restraint system. I don't want to do that. I want to keep you in whatever has been crash-tested and we know works. We start messing with stuff. We take more chances. Okay. For the steering, there's some samples right there on top of that simulator. These are different interfaces. This is called the tri-pin. Thank you. Dr. Jaffe will demonstrate. That allows you to drive. You don't have to have finger control. You don't even have to have wrist control with that one. For that one, you're pretty much driving from your shoulder. This one right here, you don't have to have finger control. Slide it right into the V, and you're driving with your wrist. That's the one he just showed you. Spinner knob. If you need to be using your gas brake with another hand, you certainly cannot let go of the steering wheel at any time. You're in the middle of a turn. You let go to go do something, your car is going to self-correct and you're going to go off the highway. All right, so then we look at the gas brake. My right foot, numbness, tingling, I move it to the left. Simple. Now, although this is one of the simplest modifications we do, it's also the most dangerous modification we do. Did you hear about the person who crashed into a whole pile of people over in Santa Cruz? That's it. The reason this happens is not because the driver got in and stepped on the wrong one. It's because the driver got out and said, oh, please park my car. So the valet gets in, steps on the brake, poof, off it goes, because that's the gas. Okay? Or they had too much to drink, so they said, oh, I'm not going to drink, I'm a responsible driver, please drive me home. Someone else gets in the car, their best friend, their family member, woof, off they go. Okay? So all these things are very easily removed. And we put stickers all over the bloody car. But this is still the most dangerous because it's just something you don't see. It's not right in front of your face. You're going to step on it. Off you go. I love it, but it is dangerous. I tell you. Okay, so gas brake. Right over there, I have an example of what's called a push rock. You push for the brake. You rock it down towards your leg for the gas. Underneath that table, I can switch those out. There are push rock, push pull, push right angle, which is the most common one. It's a push for brake, right angle down towards your leg for the gas. The advantage of these conversions is you can do gas and brake together. You're in San Francisco, you need to do that. If you're not in San Francisco, maybe you find that too complex. I can do something like push-pull. That means you cannot do gas and brake at the same time. This is also a gas brake. This can be either electronic, push for the brake, pull back for the gas. It then goes either to a computer and tells the gas brake, or it's a mechanical version. Mechanical, oh, that's the air touch. This is the air version of that. The other one's electronic. It literally pumps air into here and pushes a little cylinder down on the brake. pushes the gas, pushes the brake. We want to maintain the integrity of the vehicle as much as possible. You sell it, you want resale, or you, let's say, have autonomic dysreflexia, or get in some sort of accident. I need you to drive me, but you've never driven adaptive equipment. I want you to be able to get into that seat and drive me to the hospital. Okay? If I pull out the steering wheel, you're not going to be able to drive it. I pulled out the gas and brake, or I blocked it entirely. You can't drive me in case of an emergency. Here, it's not comfortable, but yes, I can still drive the gas and the brake. If I pulled the seat out, you're screwed. You've got to find another way. Okay? This one here is a unit. This is actually the Smith system. This person is doing the brake forward, gas backwards, right turn, supination, pronation is left turn. Okay? And if he has any sort of wrist movement or whatever, you can also throw in turn signals, wipers, that sort of stuff. And I'll show you how in just a moment. This system, as I mentioned, we start simple for multiple reasons. Number one, which is safety. Number two is it's less expensive. This system is over $100,000. Now, that's just this system, not the vehicle itself, not the lowered floor, not the ramp, not the lockdown system, just that. There's a joystick version as well. Guess how much? About $100,000. Okay? When you go high-tech, you're paying some big bucks. Can it be done? Yes, it can. Auxiliary controls. You got to get into gear. You got to turn on your lights. That's what these buttons do. This individual uses a mouth stick, puts the stick in his mouth. He pushes the buttons. That stick then controls these auxiliary controls. This is to show you the amount of space we need to get that wheelchair in there. We've lowered the floor. This is a 11-inch drop. So we dropped the floor 11 inches. You can now drop it up to 14 inches. The new 2011 Toyota's just started that. Notice, no steering wheel, no airbag. Okay, zero effort steering. These are those touchpad controls. Now we've moved to steering wheel. This is an electronic steering wheel. I can do it over here. I can do it over here, man. This is all the range I have, right, left. Okay? Preferably, I leave the main steering wheel in. If I'm doing electronic steering wheel, we have to deactivate that steering wheel. In which case, you need help. I can't help you. I can't drive. Okay? There's always a balance, and you have to kind of weigh that balance and let everybody know, you go in informed. And by the way, we can actually mount the steering wheel, and we have in the past, and has, I haven't, on the floor. And you can drive with your foot. There's one where a shoe is actually bolted in. You slide your shoe into the shoe, your foot into the shoe, and you can drive with your foot. I've seen it done. Scary as all get out.
What do these people have to do to be certified drivers? Do they have to go through you or somebody else?
To become a certified specialist or to be able to drive?
No, to be able to drive.
Okay. First you need to be, let's say you have a physical disability or something. First of all, do you have an active driver's license? I can't get you behind a wheel unless you do. If you don't have one, I help you get a permit so you can drive with me, the instructor. A private evaluation, and even the VA evaluation, my initial evaluation is approximately 2 hours. There's a clinical evaluation. I need to know everything there is about you. Not only do I review your chart forever, but I contact your physicians, I contact your ophthalmologist, your optometrist. 90% of the information you get as a driver is visual. I need to know you're seeing it. I need to know you're processing it quickly, and you're understanding what you're seeing. So I spend a lot of time on that. So I do my hour evaluation, and once again, it's the minimum. Most of my evaluations have been 3 hours lately because people have you have issues. That's just the initial. Then I'll get you into a car. Can you access this? Gas brake. I'll worry about the others later. I can figure those out. Gas brake. Can you do it? If you can, what's the modification? What do I need to get you into the car? Do you have enough headroom? Is there enough width? Do you weigh too much? The ramp, can it tolerate your weight? Okay, all these things have to be addressed.
Are you the one who actually signs off that they're certified?
Yes.
Yes. So when the DMV comes by, they say,
you still need... This is what happens. They don't even go to the DMV until after they're done with me. You have to learn... If you go to the DMV and you can't pass their test, you don't drive. So they will come to me. And I will teach. I will modify everything. I get it all set up. We train you. I sign off. You get a report. The doctor gets a report. Then you go to the DMV. The DMV says, okay, you want a driver's test? They contact your doctor. The doctor says, yes, I have a report. He's medically cleared to drive, and he's demonstrated the skills appropriate to drive, because the DMV doesn't want to die either. No one wants to get into a car with you. Okay? Think about it. You're the guy at the DMV. You're like, can he drive? I don't know. You know, you're not going to get into the car unless someone else has done it first. I'm first. I don't know why that is, but I am. So, you get cleared through me. I say, okay, you're good to go to the DMV. You go to the DMV. You take that test. If I've sent you there, you're going to pass. Okay. I will rarely tell somebody, not so much, sure. If I'm not so much sure, you know, my big concern is you go to the DMV, you pass their test. That's it. That's a 40, and by the way, it's not the 15-minute test you take as a team. It's about an hour long. And it's fairly intense. It's not as long as mine because I do you for hours and hours and hours. But you're going to pass that test. I don't want you going to take that test if you're going to pass it and still get into an accident because I feel responsible. I'm a professional. So anyways, let's get through this and I want to show you the other stuff.
How many vehicles on the U.S. are modified each year?
Don't know.
In the U.S., that's a big question.
How many drivers are there that have some...
I can tell you how many people I've seen last year.
That'd be a good start.
I saw 300 people last year.
Not all of them, but they're professional drivers independently. But I can tell you that a lot of people in the private sector can't afford it. I mean, when someone calls me in the private sector and say, I want to drive, I'm a new driver, I have one arm function. I say, can I drive? I could do a clinical evaluation, but I'll let you know up front, if you're talking a one-arm drive, you're looking at probably $100,000 worth of vehicle modifications. Is that doable for you? Is that your priority? Can you you're going to have to maintain this vehicle and maintain all the adaptive equipment and insure it. Yes, you have to tell your insurance company. I have people who don't tell their insurance companies. I say, look, you don't have to tell them if you don't want to. But if you don't tell them, you get into a car accident, they will replace your car, not your adaptive equipment. And that is not where the money is. I need a volunteer. Thank you. You hop on in. You're going to be our driving guinea pig. Simulator is great. It's a fabulous toy. It's a great tool. I use it 10% of the time. 90% of the time, I want you in a real car. I only use this if there's a reason I cannot get you in a regular car. For some reason, you don't have a license, I haven't got your permit yet, I put you in the car and you ran into four curbs and you hit another car. I don't want to do that again. Let's go in here. Let's work on it. You know, I will use this as a tool, but this is not where we spend all of our time. Okay, normally I'd make her put her seatbelt on, explain everything to her. I'm not going to be that nice. I'm going to let her crash and burn for you. Normally when I get a person, when you're ready, good luck to you. Go ahead. Drive away. Put the car in gear. There you go. And I put two hands on the wheel if I were here. So, in all fairness, what I would do with a real patient is I have four routes, each of which is approximately 15 minutes. First route is on the hospital grounds. It's about 15 miles per hour. Gives them time to get comfortable with the vehicle. Because it's not real. I tell them, I know it's not real. Don't tell me you're doing badly because it's not real, because I got that. Okay? It takes time to get used to. I will let someone get used to it. And then we increase the complexity of each route. We do hospital grounds, residential, commercial, then we go to freeway. So the complexity increases. This is telling her mirrors because she wasn't. There's red horns that appear on the side in this particular course. That tells me that she's visually scanning. When a red horn appears, she has 6 seconds to push a horn. The horn does work when those things are lit up. I'm not making her do that because this is hard enough just in front of you.
Yeah, especially the first time.
Yeah. Some people do get simulator sick.
Yeah, we're not on the straightaway.
I cannot drive this car. I get simulator sick like that. I find back here, you put me in that chair, I make one turn, I'm done. You're in the bike lane. Yeah. Now, if she's riding in the bike lane right now, normally you'd be on the left a little bit more.
Yeah, this is where you get it. Ooh.
Yeah, and I do turn out the lights and make it quiet, so you really do get immersed. It has this simulator is very nice. It has a few features. It's programmable. Cars will not hit you unless I program them to run a light. All these vehicles are going to follow the rules of the road. If you stop at a stop sign, too long, they're just going to go. They'll take the right of way. They will always try to avoid an accident whenever possible, unless I told them just to go. So there's a few cars out there that are out to just cause trouble. They will not cause an accident, but they will run a light if I told them to. But the rest of the vehicles will not. I don't want to have them fail, but I do want to have realistic actions. If she hits the curb, the steering wheel bounces back. There is a subwoofer under the chair that provides some vibration as she goes faster and slower. So it is actually pretty immersive over time.
Can you simulate bad weather?
Yes.
Yeah.
I do fog, rain, night. Yeah, we can do all that. I can change the level of complexity in regards to how busy the traffic is in each zone.
Pedestrians. There's a pedestrian over there and a bicyclist.
Yeah, pedestrian. See what happens.
Yeah.
Just to see what it does.
I had him scream. He's I programmed it.
Yeah.
Were you
Yeah.
Try hitting a car.
Go for it. Knock yourself out.
Run the stop signs.
Now it is a. Go ahead and put the car in park, please. Now back out of the other car. Otherwise, if you wait too long, it will register another accident because you're still in contact with another car.
And the bus is going to run you over again.
Yeah, and as I said, they won't try to hit you. You can hit them, but they will not try to hit you. We do use it for research. I do help with research on occasion. Honestly, I'm a clinician. I prefer to use it for training and evaluation purposes. But research is vital to what we do, so I help with that as well. This simulator is really nice about tracking everything. It knows how much percentage of time she's on the road, percentage of time she's speeding. All that data can be withdrawn from the machine. We got a guy who does that. It's lovely. At the very end of the route, it will have what's called a flash screen, and it will tell us basically 6 or 7 categories of, you know, how many cursing machine she missed. That's okay.
Why don't you program like?
Go ahead, back up out of her.
Blood splatter.
It costs more. It costs more for different visuals.
She didn't get hurt though.
No.
Oh, she's just walking.
Yeah.
Wow, she's rehabbed already.
She's a fembot. We're gonna stock the world with fembots. So anyway, anyone have any questions about any of this stuff? Sorry.
Did you program?
No. I program. There are multiple scenarios. What you're looking at is one that you worked on, I believe.
This is different scenery. But that's voice.
This is the training course. There are multiple courses. This is programmable, and yes, I have programmed several courses. I am working on a PTSD research project right now. So I do have a PTSD program in here that we're working on. I did not create these first 4 courses. They were here when I arrived. They established them for research.
Do you have a freeway simulator?
I've been at the VA. Yes. I've been at the VA for 11 years now. I've been doing this for about 3 years. Yes, sir.
Do you have a supplement like the gaming steering wheels that have force feedback?
Do I have them? Yeah. We have them on the unit, in the polytrauma unit. This does have force back steering and all that. This has all that.
I'm just thinking from cost, you could start them off on
that. No, because they're video games. And it really isn't. For training purposes, I found that to be very, very deceivingly not helpful. Yeah, because okay, I have people who do that, and they're like, oh, I've been doing, road hijacking. You know, they play that game all the time. They're like, yeah, I'm great at that game. And they get on here, and it really teaches bad judgment. you need to take this seriously. And once again, this is a video game. You know, it really is not, it's virtual reality, not reality. And I tell patients right away, I get it. It's not real.
Mirrors.
I'm thinking more signal of taking the device and then using it with some of these programs.
You can't interface that with these programs. No, this is a standalone unit. This is the built-in unit. There's 4 computers that work this. There are 4 computers you see over there to work that simulator. Yeah, each computer is for a different screen. Yeah. Yeah. It's much more complex than a video game. It looks about the same, but in regards to what information it's gathering and all that, it's much more complex.
What happens if you drive 2 times? Or what's the
maximum? You can go any place. You can go through a building.
You can go about
if you
120
want.
Miles per hour.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a virtual. The way this world is set up, it's based on the scenery and everything is based on how you set up movie sets. So it's line of sight. So if she goes off the world, she can go off the edge of the world and just keep driving. Obviously, I wouldn't let that happen in an evaluation. That would be a bad thing.
Easy on the gas.
Right. You can.
Whoa.
You can flip the car.
Oh, that's new.
You can flip. Oh yeah, you can flip it. You can skid it.
Flip it.
She needs to find a hill to do that. If you go to where there's a freeway on ramp, you can launch it. Sorry? I don't believe it's hooked up to do that. I'm not hearing any squealing. So that's not...
It'll detect if you pulled it, but he has to program it to use it.
Yeah, the radio, the fans, and the climate controls also do work. And the reason that those work is because I can do multitasking.
Mirrors. Signal right.
Any additional questions about anything?
Mirrors.
I think he caught some air there.
It's pretty forgiving.
Yeah, well, I mean, she's off the course. It's not knowing what to do with her. She might not have passed this test. Yeah. Is that someone else want to drive it? A couple minutes or whatever.
Well, you've heard hell about.
Yeah, this course doesn't have any major hills.
Can't you run up the side of a?
I think we better get going. We've got some other things to see.
No problem.
I'll take the microphone.
Good to see you. Oh, it's still the microphone.
It's my microphone.
Excellent. Now it's yours.
Thanks for being here. Thanks very much. See you, John. Okay, bye.
I try. So, as you can gather, this is a physical therapy, occupational therapy area. Like many, it's nothing very special. But it ranges from a bandsaw and a jigsaw and the kind of therapy of the past that followed basket weaving and needlework and crochet and knitting. We're starting to use computer games and the Wii and things like that to give people a little more engaging, interactive. Instead of saying do 100 repetitions, you may be actually going down a ski slope and doing something a little more interesting and having a little competition with your fellow patients, seeing who can do more. We also use some electrical stimulation muscles to activate them. But as I was saying, we don't have very much in the way of sensors to measure what people are doing, to measure their body movement, to measure the... almost none of these machines have sensors on them. I think inertia and history. I don't know there's a better reason than that. And also the mindset that has not always been very quantitative or very much into measuring. And so we... bringing in a more research-oriented mindset raises questions about what's the right number and how much should we be doing and what makes a difference and so on. In medicines, we talk about dose and response. We don't know what the right dose of exercise is for many cases. So nothing very particular about that, but I wanted also to show you the robot we have here, which is invented in Switzerland, and the VA... with veterans coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, wanted to be able to be sure that they were state-of-the-art and second to none in the equipment. So they bought, I think, 24 of these robots at about $250,000 each, and the Locomat. And I'll show you how that works roughly. So I don't know if you can see from where you are, but it starts off with a treadmill, and we have other treadmills, of course. So you can just treat it as a treadmill. But the idea was that if you go through motions, do you learn them better? And of course, for years, therapists have put patients muscles through movement, but people started having a couple of therapists standing with a patient in parallel bars like we have over there, and the therapist would move their legs, and it's rather labor intensive, but their hope was if we put people through the motions, they might get better at it and learn. Well, it's expensive to have therapists doing that, and so maybe equally expensively, this robot was developed in Switzerland, and the idea is that you strap yourself into this robot, and it fits your... There's a hip joint and a knee joint. These are all strapped onto you. And then there's a harness here which can take your weight so that you don't fall over. And you can determine how much of your weight is taken by counterweights or springs. So that even if you are completely paralyzed, you can be supported in a harness. And then to start with, this machine, where all these joints are powered, can actually walk for you. And so... The motors here will put you through the motions of walking. And even if you're completely paralyzed, it'll walk for you and synchronize it with the treadmill. Of course, it'll measure what's happening as well. But then if you start to recover some ability, you can turn down the motor and then you can drive the machine instead of the machine driving you. Or you can back off the motors and let the patient pick up more activity and do more themselves. And all the while measuring position, force, acceleration, and what the person's doing and what forces they're exerting and how their gait is working. Now, the theory is, I think, that by going through the motions, you're stimulating all the sensors in the joints and the muscles and the skin. You're sending information into the nervous system, and that may have an effect on the recovery of the nerves, that we know that there's a lot of plasticity, a lot of adaptability in the nervous system. And the more you do, the more you learn to do if you have some of the wiring there. So if you do have some remaining circuitry in the nervous system, you may be able to train it just as you trained when you were first learning to walk, by giving it the appropriate sensory inputs. And
you're reinforcing the walking pattern, basically.
Yes, and there's been a lot of debate about how much of a natural pattern generator there is and how much you have to create it or on this, there has been, and it depends how much circuitry you have left. So, for example, there was a large multicenter study of this device on people with complete spinal cord injury who had no connection really with between the brain and the rest of the body, and there were very disappointing results. It didn't produce much benefit in people where there really wasn't much connection from their legs to their brain. But with people who had incomplete spinal injury, where some signals get through, or where there's more connection between the incoming sensation and the processing circuitry, there seems to be a more promising results. Where
promising is not the same.
No, and I think it's still still controversial. You know, the hope is that the more circuitry you have, the more trainable. Yes, I think the studies were initially done in people with stroke where they had quite a bit of circuitry, and I'm somewhat biased because I work with spinal cord injury where it was less successful, but I think we're seeing more and more people with spinal injury whose paralysis is incomplete, where the spinal cord is only partially interrupted, and so there is more chance for sensation to get in, to be processed and information to come back out, and to reinforce some of the circuits, some of the synapses, some of the parts of the nervous system that are open to being modified by activity. No, I haven't. And right. For the exoskeleton, the powered exoskeleton, you mean?
Yes.
Oh yeah, right. We certainly, I think you already know about E-legs and the exoskeleton from Berkeley, another one from New Zealand, another one from Israel. So that's a sort of scaled-down version of Avatar that's, if it gets to be small enough and light enough, might have some clinical application.
Have you tried this with the electrical shocks as well?
I think so, with putting electrical stimuli in to replace the motor side of things, although the intention... In conjunction. But really the intention is to train your own nerves, your own motor nerves, to the extent that you have them.
I imagine that anybody who's paraplegic would love getting on that thing for the feeling of walking again.
Yes.
I wonder how you deal with that, how you decide when somebody's not benefiting from it, when do they stop using it?
That's a good question. We had an Iraq veteran who came here, and we knew that he had a complete spinal cord injury. In fact, he had destruction of a lot of the nerves to his legs, and we were pretty sure this wouldn't help him at all. But he saw people upright. He was just dead set on trying it, and we didn't think it would help. We told him that, but he wanted to, so we said, fine, we'll not stand in your way. So he got up in it and he tried it. He loved it, and I think he thought it helped. We didn't see any difference in his function, but mentally he was pleased to try it and feel that he hadn't, at least he'd tried, and he knew what it was like to be upright again. He knew how complicated it was, and sometimes it's easier to adapt to the wheelchair when you've pushed the envelope on everything else and realized actually the wheelchair is less exhausting and less cumbersome, so it may be easier to adapt, but people often want to leave no stone unturned until they've tried it. Yes. 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 And that was a similar thing to the stand-up wheelchair. What's the name? The iBot. Yes. So the Dean Kamen's wheelchair, which would go up on two wheels and get you up to eye level with people. And some of the first users who tried that when they were up at eye level, one of them, he said, you know, for the first time he was on eye level with his wife, and he burst into tears. And it was very moving to feel you were back in the land of the upright. And yet, it's very difficult for that to, you know, I don't know that it's persisted. And for that to become a commercial success, there has to probably be more than just that. Yes.
Because the presupposition here is, and I was going to ask you but the flow of question went that way anyway. The presupposition here is cure.
And, or at least improvement.
You know, we get a Christopher Reeve kind of mess today. My first comment was, that would feel good. And I'm, you know, 30 years beyond what any social need to stand up. But still, physiologically, and the whole issues that we're talking about, to keep it up in this relation. It doesn't sound like success that was in any way part of what was measured as success. And I really think that it's extremely important as we talk about spinal cord injury, but stroke and the demographic data version kind of thing, that we be really careful not to think that that cure, I mean, I understand where you're having a lot, and of course, that's what we're pushing to the end goal. But there are other benefits.
Absolutely. Well, I think, this comes back to this question of asking the customer what's important to them. I mean, I think that the danger of the split between researchers and industry and consumers is that they often have different goals. A friend of mine liked to say the company wants to get rich, the doctor wants to get famous, and the patient wants to get better. And there's some truth to it. And potentially, they can all be successful. But they do often have different goals. And in particular, researchers and industry and so on sometimes have a preconceived notion about what's important to the customer. And even just between here and Stanford, we're not that far apart, but many researchers in an academic environment assume the most important thing to somebody in a wheelchair is to get up and walk. And as you probably know, you probably would have your own opinions about that.
Yeah.
And you've had.
I think about it, you know, when I need to change a light bulb, you know, or whatever, what's it, every 5 years now?
And so one of the relatively simple pieces of research recently that made some impact was done by a quadriplegic, Kim Anderson, who was down in Southern California. She simply did some surveys of people in wheelchairs saying, would you rank the following activities in order of importance to you? Walking, hand function, bladder, bowel, sexual, and so on. And got the word from the customer. And as you probably know, the ranking from them, if you were paraplegic, the first thing was, does anybody know? Sexual function was the first priority. And then walking, then bladder and bowel, and then walking. If you were quadriplegic, of course, the first thing was hand function, because without hands, it's hard to do anything else. And then given hand function, then sexual function, then bladder function, then walking. So the assumption by somebody outside the field that, well, it's all about walking, isn't it? It needs to be checked against reality. And I think that's one of the things we were talking briefly earlier about, how important it is to have a much more diverse group of people addressing these issues and to be very much focused on the need and to have the need focused by the person who's closest to the need. And one of the things we're trying to do between here and Stanford and the county hospital in San Jose, where there's a unit like this for non-veterans, we've created what we call a Stanford Partnership for Spinal Cord Injury and Repair. And part of that is to have heavy involvement of users and consumers. If we were General Motors, we would be in trouble if we didn't listen to customers. And the same applies to in medical technology, I think. That there's cupboards throughout the country filled with equipment like this that isn't used very much. And it may have made a doctor or a researcher famous. It may or probably didn't make a lot of money for the company. And some very often because it didn't make anybody better. And so there's a tremendous temptation to come up with what seems like a good idea, to invest many years of work in developing it, but not to be checking as you're going along with the potential users, and not going through that repeated iterative design cycles of, is this really scratching an itch? And otherwise, I'm inventing a back scratcher which isn't going to reach the itch. And constantly needing to involve not only the user, but people with other perspectives, the social, the economic, the political, the emotional. It's all very well inventing something that's commercially non-viable. We've had some of these FES devices which really do restore function, but it's very hard to make them commercially viable if it's a very small population of users. So you need industrialists and politicians and policymakers to be involved in this whole design process, I think. That it's in some ways messier, but necessary to have a really diverse group of people because we're dealing with such complex systems. And we need to have the input from all these different sensors in society that tell us what the different factors are for success. And sometimes the comes from much simpler devices. And on the way out, I'd like to show you one that was invented in David's building that has actually in clinical use. So I think that the field is still very much open for amateurs and for diverse groups to come up with back scratchers that really do scratch an itch. It doesn't have to be a third of $1 million back scratcher. That if you start with a real itch and then find out what really is it, then you probably have a business and you may make some good. So it's 10 to 6. I realize that some of you may need to go. I'm happy to stay if you would like to, but we'll head back along the corridor and we can just talk as we go. But I want to give you a chance to get out if you'd like to.
So how come they don't kind of use the facility, 24 hours, they can...
So, by contrast with that, with what we just saw, this is something I just pulled out of the rack on the wall, and you'll see them if you walk down the corridors. These are up and down the corridors, and you can imagine what these are for. That somebody needs to be carried out of the bed, transferred onto a different cart, got out of here. Just to go to the x-ray department or to go to another part of the hospital. It's a very simple piece of technology that was developed by a colleague of yours. Well, even you can, I'm sure you could...
It's a big, huge transfer board.
It's just a big, huge transfer board, stripped down to simple essentials. Slippery, firm, cleanable. Handles are built in. Radio transparent, exactly. And smooth, that you can slide people on and off without damaging their skin. It's really an elegant piece of design, I think, because it's simplified down to a minimal transfer board. But they're around the place because they not only are effective, they're cost effective. And if we have it next time we have an earthquake, we're going to have all of these in use, taking people out that door onto the grass. And it's a nice example that Eric Sableman designed here of technology that was refined and refined and simplified and simplified, and where it scratches an itch. And so we have them up and down the corridors, and quite frankly, we use them much more often than we use the expensive machinery. And so you might think these have all had already been invented to death, but this has been simplified down to almost as far as you can simplify it, and it's cost-effective because it's not that expensive to make, but it's a very nice design solution. So turning attention to the need and seeing what do we need to get people in and out of bed. There are very complicated hovercrafts and balloon systems and motorized systems and all sorts of ways of getting patients from one bed to another. But a simple slippery bridge without any bumps sticking out of it, and that you can lie on while you're in x-ray and the x-rays will go through it and it then come back to the ward. I'm not sure, but it might be $100. What's the official name?
White Stuff.
There's a name on the back, right underneath your, right underneath the genuine Theraphin.
We worked on, my colleague worked on one that was made out of styrofoam with fiberglass over it, and we had it sounded like this, but it was thicker, and it also had a spring system to provide tension to the neck. So if a person was suspected of having a spinal injury, neck injury, you can provide that tension during the transport instead of using hanging weights or sandbags.
But it's something which was reached commercial production and is in routine use. And then you think, like a lot of good design, you think, well, why didn't somebody think of this before? So so I think there's still plenty of things that have not been invented. There's still opportunity, and as you probably know, Stanford, there's other formal design programs which actually insist on setting a design program out into hospital and spending several months out just observing, just looking before jumping to the drawing board. And it's a great starting point. But also, as you said, there were a number of iterations before this,
right,
which were probably more complicated,
right,
some of them.
Yeah, but you have to go through those stages
to
get to this point.
Yes. And there's a wonderful quote by Oliver Wendell Holmes, whom you may know, one of our fathers of medicine. And he used to say, you know, I wouldn't give a fig for the complexity, for the simplicity this side of complexity. But I give my right arm for the simplicity of the other side of complexity. When you've gone through that process and you've honed it down to something simple and effective, then you've really achieved something. So thank you all for making the trek.
We want to really thank you for hosting us and
it's a pleasure.
Us with expert information and showing us around. It's really been a highlight of the course to come here. Really appreciate it, so thank you.
Well,
thank you. It's good to
see our taxpayers'
money going to
good. That's what it is. But I welcome, you know, the Brains Trust that you represent, and I think my contact information through David. We welcome inventors, entrepreneurs, tinkerers, and...
We have an ongoing student project here,
mm-hmm.
And there may be some... ones continuing next quarter as well, so
right.
I hope to continue to forge their relationship.
Yes, and we've been thinking also technology just to keep in touch with each other. So we're thinking creating more social networks where people such as us can keep in touch. We're going to be putting up a Facebook page about exercise and fitness and wellness and technologies, but bringing and companies that are interested in working together, because we would like to do this more than once a year, and would like to keep in touch on an ongoing basis, where people can put in their ideas and meet each other and find partners and projects in a network that we can create. So we look forward to keeping in touch during the year as well.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.